Thank you, Amy, and thank you for hosting this session. It's an incredibly important topic, and it couldn't be more timely. I think when this session was organized, since this session was organized many months ago, the situation in the world has become increasingly dire on this topic, and I imagine most of you have seen stories on the front pages of our newspapers almost daily. And so we may have reached a watershed moment where it is time for something to change. I changed the actual title of my presentation this morning because I know we've had discussions with some of our colleagues, including at the ICRC, about calling this crisis the new normal, because we don't want it to be normal, and it is abnormal. So I put it in quotes, but sadly, as we see, and even in terms of the incidents that have just occurred in the last 2 months alone, attacks on health and health professionals and health facilities are a daily occurrence, especially in conflict zones, but not only in conflict zones. This map is a map that came out in the spring of 2015. It's the second year of a joint report between Human Rights Watch and the Safeguarding Health in Conflict Coalition, which Physicians for Human Rights and SAMHSA and many other groups are part of. And it attempts to start now on an annual basis to track the violence against health and health professionals. And you probably can't see the legend here, the key, but the red are places where, and this is not comprehensive by any means, and one of the challenges is that we don't have comprehensive data, but the red is attacks on medical facilities and transport. The blue represents attacks on medical personnel and patients. The stripes, attacks on medical facilities, transport, and personnel and patients, meaning all of these kinds of violations. And the black circle with the line across is where there are government legislated restrictions to health care. So those are some of the types of attacks that are documented in that annual map, which we hope to continue to be able to produce, but hopefully with better data as time goes on and as more organizations and institutions become involved in collection of data. But essentially the types of attacks that I'm going to talk about, and I think that most of us are talking about on this panel, are those attacks that are directly on or interference with medical personnel of all sorts, attacks on or interference with people who are seeking medical care, that is patients, the sick and the wounded in times of conflict, and then attacks on facilities and transport themselves, literally direct bombing and shelling of hospitals and clinics, as well as attacks on ambulances and other people transporting the sick and the wounded. So I'm just going to quickly go over a number of examples and some images from around the world. My organization and I, along with it, have been documenting attacks on health facilities and health personnel for almost 30 years. We started doing this very early on in our history, 1986, when Chilean doctors were arrested for treating torture survivors and sent to jail, and in El Salvador when both parties to the civil war there actually sometimes used hospitals as staging areas for military attacks or directly attacked hospitals, and where both parties to that conflict eventually negotiated with each other to respect the principle of non-attack or protection of hospitals and health. But in Kosovo, we saw more than 100 health facilities destroyed in the 90s. In Chechnya, in that horrible war, at least 24 medical facilities were damaged by federal forces, and doctors were arrested. In Iraq, in which we'll hear about much more later, we've seen the kidnapping and murder of health workers, as well as the destruction of facilities. And in many parts of Iraq, a good percentage of doctors in certain areas of the conflict have left the country. This picture actually is not of South Sudan, so just I don't want to mislead you. This is actually a picture of Somalia, but it's used to illustrate here a similar phenomenon where Hospitals actually are all too frequently entered by military forces with guns, where patients are actually removed at gunpoint from hospitals. It's not only in South Sudan where this has happened. It did happen. This picture is actually all the way back from the 1980s in Somalia. A similar situation. I just got an email this morning in the Al-Maqasid Hospital in East Jerusalem, where Israeli soldiers have been seizing medical records of patients and so forth. Of course, in Gaza, we saw regular attacks during that last conflict there on ambulances, the killing of paramedics, attacks on hospitals, an obstruction of access to the wounded. We may hear more about that later. You probably all know, and I'm going to let Doctors Without Borders talk about the horrible attack and killing of patients and health staff in Kunduz, Afghanistan. But in addition, over the years, there have been military takeovers of clinics. This Kunduz attack is not the first or only attack on health in Afghanistan. There have been landmines and other ordnance placed near clinics, which unfortunately then make it very precarious for a health facility to be there, because it may become an intentional or a so-called accidental target, as what we heard about so-called collateral damage. And then incredible lack of access to clinics because of insecurity. And of course, we see this in many conflicts where the hospital, rather than becoming a place of safety and healing, becomes the one place that is too dangerous to go to that you don't want to go to, because you're going to be attacked or killed or shot at or bombed on the way or while you're there. Physicians for Human Rights has worked extensively, as well as other human rights organizations, on the targeting of health professionals in Bahrain. Now, this is a situation that's not like a war, a declared war. It's a situation of civil unrest. So I want to distinguish between full-out armed conflict and situations where people have been, health professionals have been arrested, hospitals have been barricaded by tanks and soldiers so that patients can't get in, or patients are searched for their identities, maybe even arrested on trying to reach care. But this is a case of peaceful demonstrators all the way back in 2009, where doctors and nurses came to their aid because they were tear gassed and sometimes shot at or when they demonstrated for their rights. And then the doctors and nurses who treated these demonstrators, these injured demonstrators, were arrested for treating the patients. And these many doctors in Bahrain have been taken from their homes in the middle of the night, brought to prisons without a charge or a trial, and tortured in some cases. And again, this made the hospital in Bahrain a place that people were afraid to go to. Turkey, we've seen thousands of protesters in the Gezi Park demonstrations starting in 2013, where emergency volunteer doctors, many of them with the Turkish Medical Association, came to their assistance, and hospitals then were tear gassed, and medical personnel were detained for treating demonstrators. And now the Turkish government has passed laws making it a criminal act to provide unauthorized, in quotes, medical care. So what are the consequences of all of these kinds of attacks? And I'm sure all of you in the field of public health and medicine, international health, can imagine these easily yourselves and already will know what they are. But just to reiterate here, the direct effect on civilian populations and medical personnel and health facilities, obviously people are directly injured and wounded. But there's a compounding effect on the access, as we've mentioned, to health care that has consequences for the mortality and morbidity of civilians. The targeting of the infrastructure itself and its destruction disproportionately affects, and this is documented in quite a number of studies, and it's obvious, the vulnerable, including children, mothers, and the elderly, who find it much more difficult to avoid all of these risks and get to safe health care, or even unsafe health care. And then, of course, because of this, there are reductions in the health care capacity because medical personnel leave. And we're going to hear a lot more about that from our next speakers, I have no doubt. Ultimately, the destruction of these services undermine both the short and long-term capacity to deliver healthcare, and in some of the most egregious situations, literally destroy entire health systems, which is, it's unbelievable what's going on. And you're going to hear from our next speaker, Zahir Salul, about Syria. This is just one visual sort of depiction of the last 4.5 years of direct attacks by government forces on healthcare and health facilities in Syria. I'm not going to go into the data, but they're really horrifying. 313 attacks on 224 medical facilities, at least, and more than 679 deaths of medical personnel. Now, there are also indirect consequences, and these are some of them: psychological scarring, eroded mental health treatment, the spread of infectious disease, the cost of pharmaceuticals and difficulty of getting pharmaceuticals to their locations, obvious impact on maternal health care, both prenatal care and postnatal care, and the treatment of chronic diseases. So why is this happening? It's happening because health care services to an enemy or an alleged terrorist are often considered an act against the state, and then the states justify their attacks. There's often now, and we may end up seeing this in the case of the U.S. attack on the Kunduz hospital, there's this notion that there's a predominance of strategic or tactical military considerations over respect for health, a very alarming situation, and lack of knowledge or interest in the requirements of the Geneva Conventions, which are the principles which have for many decades been largely upheld in many conflicts and are now completely being eroded. And, of course, impunity, the fact that time after time after time, perpetrators of these violations are getting away with it. These are just one little slide. I hope you'll learn these if you're going into a war zone and you're interested in this issue. You'll look up the Geneva Conventions, but the basic principle that we care about here is that the wounded and sick shall be the object of particular protection and respect, and that is not happening. Now, I just want to... what do I have, about a minute? I want to talk about, for a few minutes, and forgive me, because this is the most important part of my talk. It'll be quick. The human rights approach to this is a little bit different from the humanitarian one, and we're going to hear both, and I think they're complementary. But we need to figure out how to not only look at humanitarian law, like the Geneva Conventions, but human rights law, and human rights practice. So we need to gather data, and some of that data needs to be made public. And we need political pressure to stop these attacks. The human rights response involves the reinforcement and expansion of the norms that should protect health in conflicts. They require us to have an international regime, which we believe the WHO and others should have, an institute of ongoing monitoring, surveillance, and public reporting, and then accountability for perpetrators. And that should include public protests, media exposure, more formal mechanisms through the UN and regional bodies, much more aggressive and stepped-up diplomacy, and ultimately the prosecution of perpetrators. The UN passed its first General Assembly resolution on this topic in December, and these are the requirements of that resolution. Some of the ways that monitoring and surveillance can be done are now being experimented with by NGOs like ours, with the Syria map that you see on your right, but also with Len Rubenstein's and Hopkins Bloomberg's effort to try to develop an app that's going to actually document in detail attacks on health professionals and health facilities. The accountability must involve more forums and mechanisms for actual accountability. There's very little of that going on right now. We can talk about that maybe in the Q&A. And I just want to end with this quote from one of our colleagues, a Syrian colleague, who told us in our offices a week ago, and it's so obvious, you must be safe to save others. So the Safeguarding Health and Conflict Coalition is a coalition of many organizations that's growing. It's high time for something like this to be much larger and much more impactful. I have flyers about the coalition in the back. And just to leave you with some sense of the solidarity that should and must be evoked more and more and more as this issue hits the global arena and the global consciousness, This was Zahir's organization, Doctors Without Borders, and PHR, and many others, right near the UN this past Thursday, where we staged a die-in to defend doctors in Syria. The signs say, targeting a hospital is a war crime, calling on the UN to protect Syrian health workers, and calling on the individual perpetrators to stop these egregious violations that affect health and healthcare and are truly crimes when they're carried out, as we see in Syria, crimes against humanity. Thank you.
Thank you, Susanna.